coming up on Broadway Videos. This week on Broadway, we talk about Hello, Dolly! At the Goodspeed Opera House. We also talk about Monkey at the Coke, talk about the Explorers Club at MTC, and Pirates of Finance and Mary Harry at Nymph. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway for Sunday, July 22nd, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books to his credit, the most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen in followspotphoto.com as well as many other places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. So the both of you got up to East Haddam, Connecticut to see Hello, Dolly! At the Goodspeed Opera House. Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
I thought it was a terrific production, and one thing I liked very much is, as much as I loved Clea Blackhurst in the role, because she has the confidence, she has the style to play Dolly, the thing that I really liked, too, was that Tony Sheldon is playing Vandegelder. He's a good-looking man, he's a virile man, and we've never had that before in any Dolly that I've ever seen. I'm not saying David Burns wasn't wonderful, of course he was, but, you know, this Vandegelder really seemed like a catch. You know, I don't mean just because he has $500,000 in the bank, or at least is worth $500,000. What I mean is that he's handsome, tall. So as a result, it becomes more interesting to me that that there could be that type of attraction going on. So in the show where she says, you know, to Ephraim, her late husband, when she talks to him directly, it won't be a marriage like we had. By the end of the show, you think, you know, maybe it will. Maybe it will indeed. It's a very nice production, and I really commend Daniel Goldstein for directing it so well. It reduces extraordinarily well. I didn't think it would, because Goodspeed is a very small stage. So I like very much that it was such a... it fit right with the stage, because there was the set designer really did a very nice job in recycling boxes and from one scene to the next. A two-level set that worked very, very well, too. You have to have a second level for when she comes down the staircase. The night I was there, the Waiters' Gallop really tore down the house. I mean, it was certainly one of the best received numbers, and that was nice to see as well. So Ashley Brown sings beautifully in the role of Irene Malloy, so that was great, too. But Clea really takes the bull by the horns, and what's so nice is she doesn't imitate anybody. She doesn't worry about being Carol Channing or Ethel Merman or anybody in between. She's just interested in doing the part, doing her best at it, and she succeeds wildly.
I agree. There were so many little things that I noticed in Tony Sheldon's performance. Did you notice one thing, Peter? When Dolly makes her famous entrance into the Harmonia Gardens, and you know they do the number and it tears the house down, and then after that is when he first sees her there, and there was really a moment where he kind of looked shocked at how great she looked, you know, uh-huh. when she's all done up, and I thought that was very smart of him, you know. I mean, it's a little weird if suddenly in the last scene he, like, completely out of nowhere decides he's going to marry her.
Well, I'm going to add something I should have added while I was speaking, and that is the fact that during the famous "It Only Takes a Moment" scene, where Cornelius is essentially proposing to Irene, the expression on Tony Sheldon's face really said, "This is what I've been missing." This is what's been absent from my life. What a fool I've been. And that is very smart, too, because it sets up his change in the next scene. Oh, he still resists in the next scene. He brings up his last stand of fighting. But nevertheless, he paves the way. So you're right there that he does see something there and says, wow, you know, this lady cleans up really well.
Yeah, absolutely. I interviewed him for Broadway Stars a few weeks ago. I can send the link and we can include it in the show notes. But he said, I asked him about that, you know, something along the lines of, well, he is kind of almost a stock character in many ways. Mm-hmm. You know, so how much do you play that and how much do you try to humanize him? And he basically said, well, you know, you can't, you know, you don't want to go against what's written, but there are, you know, maybe little things you can do to make him more of a, you know, more of a person and less of a stereotype. And I thought he did he struck a perfect balance with that, because if you went too far the other way, that wouldn't be right either. I mean, that just wouldn't be Hello, Dolly. I mean, he is a curmudgeon and he's a miser and blah, blah, blah. So I thought he was perfect at that. And I completely agree about Clea. She has that fantastic voice. One might think, you know, if one had to pick someone that she resembles most, it would probably be Merman, because sure, she's done Merman so much. But, you know, but she really was very different from Merman.
Absolutely. I'll tell you one thing that occurred to me about Merman, that famous Irving Berlin quotation, that when you write lyrics, they better be good, because when Merman sings them, everybody's going to hear them. And that was true of this, too. I mean, every syllable was clarion clear.
Absolutely. I thought it was a very, very strong production overall. I agree about the direction and the set design by Adrian Jones, costumes Wade LaBoissonniere, lighting Jason Lyons. I saw the show yesterday, and interestingly enough, during the Waiters Gallop, we had two very brief blackouts. There was a thunderstorm outside. I don't know if it had anything to do with that, but it was odd because everything went out, but only for like 10 seconds. And then everything came back on again. And that happened twice. And we were talking afterwards with some of the cast, and they said, you know, it was ironic that it happened during the Waiters Gallop, because it's so frenetic and, you know, it could really be dangerous if you're doing it in the dark. So, but they, as it happened, they did not stop yesterday, because, as I say, it was very brief. But I do think that there was one little bit that they left out, because there was one moment when Rudolph was standing on the steps and nothing was really happening, and he kind of helped it out by doing a little dance, and then he walked over to the, you know, to the curtain and pulled it back on one of the dining rooms. But so that was quite a moment. Oh, and another interesting thing about that is I think both times when the power went out, when it came on, initially the sound did not come on immediately. And so we did get a taste of what it would sound like completely acoustic, because the sound wasn't on the band and it wasn't on the singers. And honestly, I think they could have done it that way. you know, and it's not aggressively amplified as it is, but you know, I mean, it's such a wonderful little jewel box of a theater, and was designed obviously in the days well before amplification. Very, very, very strong production. Jeremy Morse was terribly appealing as Barnaby, really cute. And I thought, yes, Ashley Brown, I thought it was the best thing I've seen her do. I thought she brought a lot to a character who can also be something of a, can sometimes be something of a, you know, a dish rag. Mm-hmm. I did think there were two or three cases of very odd miscasting. And considering how perfectly everyone else was cast, I'm not really sure what that was about. I thought that the fellow who played Cornelius was not right. It's a difficult part because he's certainly not a typical romantic leading man. I mean, he has to come across as kind of callow and somewhat shy and nerdy, maybe. But I think in this case, maybe they went really too far into the character man area, and I thought that was very distracting to me. He seemed more like a Ray Bolger than what I see in the part. Although, again, it's really tough. I mean, I think of all the Corneliuses I've seen, I can think of only two who were right. One was Anthony Perkins in
that
the
movie. Oh,
yeah, The
that
Matchmaker.
That movie is phenomenal. Oh.
Yeah, I haven't checked lately. I hope it's available.
It's definitely been on DVD. I have it on DVD, and it is magnificent. Shirley Booth, Shirley MacLaine, Paul Ford, Robert Morse. What a cast! An extraordinary movie. And also, what's interesting is a lot of people give Dolly credit for being the first incarnation of the Matchmaker to drop that third act. And no, the movie drops the third act too, that Thornton Wilder wrote. And I think it's a good decision to drop that third act. I don't think it's needed. I think everything gets wrapped up without that third act that Thornton Wilder wrote for both The Merchant of Yonkers and The Matchmaker. So,
I'm going to have to get my hands on that because everyone, if anyone who hasn't seen it really should see it. It's just so well done.
Truly one of my top 10 favorite movies, seriously.
I'm surprised it's not more famous. But anyway, so yes, I thought Cornelius was oddly, and Minnie Fay looked 14, which I didn't think worked, you know, with the rest of the cast. I'm not sure, you know,
I like that she was grounded and not silly, though. I like that very much.
I see what you mean, but I think she went a little further that direction. I saw, I'll never forget it, with Merman, it was Georgia Engel, uh-huh. who was absolutely adorable and perfect. Mm-hmm. And then the other miscasting was, well, this was an ensemble person who played several roles, but the woman who played Ernestina was very good. But I mean, there's a specific reference to the fact that she has that her waist is 47, and it's always been done. I mean, I hate to say it, I guess maybe it's just not. I guess it's less palatable to us today, but it's written as a fat joke. You know, mm-hmm. in the original, and they didn't do it that way, which is, you know, maybe that's fine, but then drop the 47 line, you know, because mm-hmm. she didn't have her waist wasn't 47. It looked like it was about 32 or less. So other than that, though, I thought it was just perfect. I thought it would be a perfect show for there. They did reduce it very, very well, as Peter said, like having a second level in several of the scenes helped greatly to get a considerable amount of people on stage at one time, you know, whether it's dancing or singing or just observing. And it's only an 8-piece orchestra that amazing how the size of the venue can affect that, because it really, I would never have guessed. If you asked me, I would have said, I don't know, 12 or 14 pieces.
I agree.
Very well chosen. Didn't really hardly miss anything except the masked strings. And those aren't really that important in this show anyway. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a triumph, and I'm so glad we went. I would probably go back, and I may try to. It's a trek, as we've said before, but absolutely worth it in this case.
So, Michael, you were able to get together with a group of friends and head up there all together as a pack?
Yes, and that helped greatly. We rented a car and, you know, split it between four people. You can take the train to, I always forget, is it Old Saybrook?
Somewhere.
Yeah.
It's on the Goodspeed Opera House website.
Yeah, you can. You can do that and then take a cab. And if you're with at least one other person, the cab won't be prohibitively expensive. I just wish in my fantasy that they would develop some kind of method to make it easier for people coming from out of town, like maybe run vans from the train or something like that. I realize it's not easy to do, but they do such great stuff there. I was reminded that they've won two Tony Awards. Mm-hmm. They're most famous for originating Man of La Mancha, Annie, and Shenandoah. So even if it was only those three shows, you know, I mean, for heaven's sake. But it's just a beautiful, wonderful, fantastic place.
So that was at the Opera House. Have you been down to Norma Terrace, either one of you?
Have been there only once to see. It was the Flight of the Lawn Chair Man.
Yeah.
And that was a terrific production too. Peter has said that he's been there several times, I guess.
Yeah, and God love them for having a second space where they develop new musicals.
Yes.
Because this theater was set up to do musicals of the past. It was so interesting. In the 60s, they were doing shows from the 20s, which seems so long ago. And, of course, that's 40 years. And here's Dolly about to celebrate its 50th anniversary. So time does march on.
So they're doing something called LMNOP at the Norwood Terrace right now. Any plans to go up to see that?
Possibly, yeah. It's been a very busy summer for me, so we'll see. But I have given it some thought. Believe
the title caught my eye. I really don't know anything about it, but
I think it's based on a book that's something like called ABCDEFG. You know, I mean, something like that. So
one interesting thing is there in the fall, I believe they're doing Most Happy Fella.
Yes.
And that's going to be done at Encores, but I guess they don't consider it a conflict because
they're far away.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Dolly is playing through September 14th at the Opera House, and then September 20th through December 1st is the Most Happy Fella. So perhaps right around that time, the three of us will talk about Most Happy Fella.
Yes.
Absolutely. All right, so Peter, moving on, how is your Mandarin?
Oh, not so good, actually. So as a result, I had a difficult time with Monkey, Journey to the West. Truth to tell, of course, they subtitle everything, but this is the type of show at the Koch Theater. Is that it? Koch? Coach?
Coke.
All right, fine. I'm doing the best I can here.
No, you're not. You're doing it on purpose.
Oh, you think so, huh?
Yeah, but it's probably...
That's okay. Yeah. Most people just call them dicks.
Right, yes, indeed. All right, but that's another story. Anyway, so this is this big, elaborate production that comes from the Far East, and it's certainly lavish. The costumes, the scenery, the lighting, really something. And I'll be damned if I know what it's about. I stopped paying attention after a while because I just couldn't tie into the story. But it is quite a spectacle. I mean, I guess I was turned off from the beginning when the monkey was born. He comes out of the egg. You might have even seen the TV commercial where they do an animated version of this. And he says, "So much fun. This is cool." I have an aversion to these trendy expressions that are given to characters that natively don't talk. I wish that they would not speak in such jargon that's supposed to make us like them immediately because they are, as he says, cool. But anyway, it didn't do much to me. The translation too. I mean. When you see lines like "calm down," I have a phoenix plumed helmet. I mean, you know, I mean, so the monkey scratches his crotch a lot too. I'll tell you, you know, I mean, that happens quite a bit. I bet that happened 24 times. So, a lot of martial arts, if you like that type of thing, they're doing it very, very well. So many plays have the note in the program later that evening. This one had 500 years later. So, so it really is epic in scope. But you know, when you see lines up there, translated saying, "Take care to govern both spirit and sperm." I'm just not paying attention anymore. I just don't know what the story was. However, you know, this is what they're doing over there. This is their musical theater. And if you want to expand your horizons and see what's going on in the other part of the world, what musical theater is to them. Certainly music was very appealing, by the way. I should mention that, you know, very appealing. It fell very nicely on the ear, but I just couldn't get into what it meant, what it was dealing with, what the message was. And I gave up pretty quickly, which may be a flaw in me, I'll grant you, and probably is even, but it just didn't interest me enough to try.
So I'm going to link to it in the show notes. They have a website called monkeyjourneytothewest.com, and they have a free download of the Monkey Bee remix. But there's a video there that you can watch that that I took a look at. It seems reminiscent of sort of like a competitor to the same entertainment space that Cirque du Soleil is in. Is that accurate?
Well, there is a lot of that, I will admit. I mean, there's a lot of jumping around and martial arts, you know, that type of thing. I prefer Marshall Brickman to martial arts, but what can I say? But yes, yeah, I should have mentioned that.
So, yeah, speaking of Cirque du Soleil, we have news that Ka, the show out in Vegas where there was a performer had died a couple of weeks ago, started its performances again. We hadn't mentioned it on the broadcast in the last couple of weeks, but certainly we all did know about that, and we got some emails about it. But it's one of those things, you know, I don't know what to say about it. We've all seen Cirque du Soleil shows and been in awe of the danger there that or the amazing feats that the performers do, but sometimes these things happen, and we'll have to see what happens in the investigation to find out if it was just merely an accident. So Michael and Peter got a chance to see the Explorers Club. So Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
I came to it late. I had heard great things about it, and I'm so glad I went because I absolutely adored it. It's at Manhattan Theater Club, and in their bigger off-Broadway space, Stage One, and it's by Nell Benjamin, and I absolutely loved it. It's very, very, very funny and farcical and satirical. This is one of those cases where it's interesting. I have read some reactions to it that were very negative, but to me, I have to say, I mean, if you don't like that type of theater, something that's very over the top and very satirical, very farcical, not realistic in any way, if you don't like that, then I obviously can understand why you really would not like this play. But if you do like that style and just feel that it wasn't done well in this case by the writer or the director or the actors, then I can't even comprehend how anyone could have that reaction, because I just thought it was brilliant. And I have to say, the audience was in stitches. It's about, I'm going to say what it's about, but what it's about is like practically beside the point. It's about a woman who tries to join this very exclusive all-male club in London in 1879. It's one of those very, very traditional, stodgy British clubs. And I guess this had a lot of extra weight for me because I actually worked in an American counterpart of one of those clubs for several years. And so the whole milieu of it was very, it's not the club that I worked at in the 90s in America is not quite the same as this club in 1879 in London. But there were similarities, especially in the decor and the whole feel of it. And the club that I worked at, actually, when I started working there in the late 80s, early 90s, it had been an all-male club for 125 years or something like that. And they were just then starting to let in women because they were made to do so by the law. They just had to. Hopefully they would have done so anyway eventually. But they had to let women in, and in order to kind of ease the transition, like the first group of women they let in included people like Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Mm. I mean, it was like the most famous, you know, well-respected women in the world. So that's my personal background to the play, but it's so hilarious because the club that she's joining is called the Explorers Club and made up of people who supposedly go exploring all over the world. And she really wants to be part of them. And she brings this fellow, this like tribesman named, improbably named Luigi, played by Carson Elrod, in an absolutely brilliantly funny performance. And she brings him from whatever, I forget the name of the country, some obscure place. And he's in full like native makeup, with the spiky hair. And the what they do is to avoid, it's interesting, they do the same thing that they did in the recent Encores production of On Your Toes. We obviously can't have anything like blackface in the theater nowadays, except in very, very rare instances. And so they have him, Carson Elrod, in blue makeup, you know, as if it was like some very elaborate tribal makeup. So that's how they handle that. But it's, but in this case, it's so cartoonish and so unrealistic that, it's scarcely an issue. And there are all these highly improbable plot elements of people, going off to explore and then coming back. And there's also political element this, riot that almost occurs, and John McMartin, the amazing John McMartin, plays this fellow who has these crazy ideas that the Irish people are really Jewish because of where their descendants came from. it's just nuts, but I loved it. Jennifer Westfeld is the central female character, and in fact, the only female character, the one who's trying to get into the club. The rest of the cast is made up of people I'm very familiar with. David Furr and Lorenzo Pizzoni are kind of rivals, and also rivals for the affections of Jennifer Westfeld. And then Mr. McMartin, as I mentioned. Arnie Burton, who's been fabulous in several plays. And then a couple of people I was not as familiar with, Brian Avers and Max Baker and Stephen Boyer, who I've seen in a few things also. But
actor.
Yes, definitely. Directed by Mark Bruni to perfection. I'm so glad I went. It's another play I would consider really buying my way back into, because it was a complete delight, and I'm so, so glad I caught up with it.
So, Peter, what did you think?
Well, Michael pretty much said it all. The only thing he didn't mention was the fact that there is some tremendous choreography with drinks that are served
from
the bar. You know, that I don't know how much they must have rehearsed to get this right, because what happens is Luigi is employed as a bartender there, and the way he serves drinks is not very gracious, and and the way that they have to catch the drinks that he flings at them is really quite amazing. And they don't just do this once. I mean, I was flabbergasted that this happened so often that I didn't see a single drink spilled, as drinks were being hurtled across the bar at speeds not unknown at the Indianapolis Speedway. I mean, it was incredible to watch that. What's really good about Nell Benjamin is such a clever lady. This is the woman who was working on Legally Blonde and did very good work there. But it's very great to see her expand and do a farce like this, completely different from a musical and completely different from Legally Blonde. The sensibility is very different. She's fully in control of what she's doing. She knows exactly what she's doing. So much of the time, you think it's simply going to be a story about a woman who's trying to crack a men's club. You know what I mean? And that's where they start. It's not remotely all that's on her mind. And that's what's so good, because, I mean, in the first 5 minutes, you hear the arguments about this and you say, okay, I get it. That's what this is going to be about. And you think to yourself, well, we've seen a lot of stories like this, and no, that's just her jumping off point. And believe me, there's a lot of jumping that goes around in this play. And I had a wonderful time at it. I should also mention the set is glorious. The set, it really looks like one of those ornate clubs that the British had way back then. And so my hat's off to the set designer as well. So yeah, quite a good evening.
Set designed by Doniale Werle, by the way. I mean, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correct, so forgive me. But yeah, that drinks thing is amazing. I actually didn't look close enough to see first of all, Peter, could you tell if it was, I mean, was it actual liquid in them?
I think so. And, I do. I thought I saw some sloshing around.
Yeah. And even if it wasn't, you know, or if it was something, you know, if he didn't fill it up, you know, that much. But just the fact that not a single one was dropped, not a single catch was missed. I sat next to another theater journalist and I said, I mean, do they ever miss? There has to be, what would you say, like 35 times that it happened?
I don't think that's out of the question. At the very least, 24. You know, so, yeah, and again, what we're talking about is sliding drinks across the bar at full speed ahead and having them catch them as they fly off the bar. So, I mean, it's pretty amazing.
And, you know, Lorenzo Pizzoni has circus training, but as far as I know, no one else in the cast does. So, you know, he's not the only one who catches the drinks. I mean, there's one point where he catches two at one time, and that's pretty amazing. So maybe they figured they'd let him do it because he has the circus training. But it's incredible, and the audience is. I mean, you're laughing, but you also like you know you're agog at what you're seeing.
Yes.
It's brilliant. Nell Benjamin, we should probably mention since she makes a point of it, is also married to Lawrence O'Keefe, with whom she worked on Legally Blonde and some mm-hmm. other things. And the last line of her bio is, "Best of all, she's married to a genius, which she highly recommends." So they're quite a team. But in this case, she did very, very well on her own.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah,
I didn't realize until you had mentioned that Jennifer Westfeldt was in it.
Yeah,
and I'm a big fan of Jennifer's, and so maybe I'll go check this out. But it's good to see her back in New York. She's been doing so much film and television work in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm.
And also how great that she picked something like this, you know, that's a really excellent piece, but not necessarily, you know, a big
commercial
Broadway showcase, yeah. You know.
Yeah, right. No question about that. And if anybody hasn't seen the movie that put her on the map, Kissing Jessica Stein, which is actually based on a play called Lipstick, I recommend it highly. It's a lovely, lovely movie. And Jennifer's, I don't mean Jennifer herself. No, I just don't remember the character name. But anyway...
Jessica.
Obviously, right, sure, look at that. Anyway, amazing, I tell you. That she's dabbling with lesbianism, and the scene in which Tova Felcher, as her mother, lets her know that she knows what she's talking about is a masterful work of subtlety in writing. So as a result, by all means, check out the Kissing Jessica Stein movie.
Yes, I remember that scene vividly, yeah. Peter, although I have not seen it since the movie came out. And I even remember specifically there's a moment in it where the acting is so realistic that it seems almost as if Tova like forgets a line, but it's done as if like, you know, I mean, in a very realistic way, as if you were speaking to someone and you started to say something, but then you stopped yourself immediately because you realized maybe that wasn't the best way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really extraordinary moment.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So Jennifer's other half, John Hamm,
right.
Is very hot commodity these days in his Mad Men television show. But I wonder if we can get the two of them on Broadway together to do something like I Do or something like that.
I'll tell you, they seem to be theater fans. I see them in the audience quite a bit together. So so that's really nice, too. They're interested in what's going on.
Absolutely. So moving on, Peter got a chance to see two shows at NIMF. One, we'll start off with the Pirates of Finance.
Yeah, this is a show that uses Sir Arthur Sullivan's music, but not... Gilbert's lyrics. Charles Veeley has put the lyrics in and the book as well. And it does deal with Wall Street. I thought this was not a good show at all. And I think it's an object lesson to watch out for certain things, because this is a show where the tail wags the dog. The reason the show probably occurred to Mr. Veeley is that the word finance somewhat sounds like the word Penzance. So as a result, yes, won't it be cute to write a show that plays on that word? So in other words, if Gilbert and Sullivan had written The Pirates of Poughkeepsie, the show wouldn't exist. You know, I mean, so, and that might be all right too. But I mean, one of the things is that it gets off to such a slow start because Mr. Villey has chosen very sedate, ballady, and recitative laden music. So the show gets off to a terribly slow start.
Really? That's odd.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, you really think you're going to hear Gilbert and Sullivan's greatest hits. And eventually you do hear some of those. But I'm telling you, at the beginning, it was just turgid. And you start even thinking, gee, this guy wasn't even a good composer. Now, of course he was. But I mean, nevertheless, it just doesn't, it's not a good showcase for him for the first 10 minutes. So it gets off to a terrible start. And it's farcical in the worst sense. We just talked about a good farce, but this one isn't good at all. So I did admire Deborah Jean Templin playing a CEO-ish type lady, not quite, but something like that. And it's just about a company and takeover and a ruthless guy and that type of business. And it's nothing you haven't seen before, I'm sorry to say. It's just that the music does not fit the characters, and that's the problem. I like when music sounds like it's the real music of the people that are singing them. For example, Next to Normal has to have a rock score because the people who are in it grew up in the rock era. Spring Awakening does not have to have a rock score. I'm not really saying that a lot of people love it, and that's great. You know, good luck to you. Enjoy yourself. But, I mean, the point is it doesn't sound like 1890 music to me, so that's something I don't like. Well, I don't like contemporary shows that have 1890 music either, and, I mean, that's what we have here. We have 19th century music in the mouths of 21st century characters, and it does not work for me at all. So I didn't like it whatsoever. I have no more to say. I'm done, you know. So,
all right. So the other thing you saw was Marry Harry.
Yeah, this wasn't very good either, but for a very different reason. I mean, this is about a girl who's getting married. All right. And there she is, wedding dress day before, trying it on, last minute preparations, and she finds out her boyfriend is in the Plaza Hotel with another woman. So, okay, she's very discouraged. She's upset, okay? And the problem is she meets Harry, who's actually her mother's tenant. Well, let's put it this way. Harry's father owns a restaurant, and the mother owns the building in which the restaurant is. And Harry's father, whose name, by the way, Harry's father is really Harry, and the person I'm talking about, who's his son, is called Little Harry throughout, which is something he doesn't much like. But anyway, so even though she has known Little Harry for a long time, suddenly he makes a pass at her and she is deeply in love with him. And within maybe 20 minutes, they're planning their marriage. And the thing is, how can we take this seriously? Because she's on the rebound, you know what I mean? And that's the big flaw in this show, that we're really supposed to get behind this couple and think they're going to make a great couple. But hold on. You know, you really, even though you've had a history together where you haven't acknowledged each other in romantic ways, suddenly it all comes together so quickly that you're getting married. And of course the families have some issues on this, and don't we all? So, I mean, it's very, very strange setup. However, that said, a woman named Gillian Lewis is phenomenal playing, the, character who is known as, I'm checking right now, Sherry. She is terrific beyond belief, warm, winning, charming, pretty, endearing. I can't say enough about how good she is as far as that's concerned. Philip Hoffman is excellent as, shall we say, Big Harry. And Rob Sapp is excellent too as Little Harry. And also we have two Broadway vets of the cast who do very, very nicely. Annie Golden plays Big Harry's girlfriend. They have some issues as time goes on too. She has a very good number in the second act that really got very nice response the day I was there. And Jane Summerhays, who we may remember from Me and My Girl, plays the landlord and indeed the mother of Sherry. So so the performances are good, and the music is occasionally good by Dan Martin. But good Lord, I mean, how can we take a romance seriously that starts up so quickly? Haven't we all been through enough where we, you know, say, well, we've got to be careful? R.S. Cole Porter said, you know, too hot not to cool down. You know, and, you know, so we just can't get behind the romance.
So that's, I guess that wraps up our... our Nymph coverage. Michael, did you see anything at Nymph that you wanted to talk about?
No, I'm starting today with two shows. I have God's Country at 5. And then I have Gary Goldfarb at 9.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually I'm seeing Mary Harry on Tuesday and Legacy Falls, which I'm hearing good things about, on Wednesday. And then Crossing Swords. And I think maybe that's my last one. I'm not sure.
I'm seeing Crossing Swords as well.
All right.
But yes, I have heard wonderful things about Legacy Falls. Mm. I wish I could fit it in, but they asked me to be a judge of the festival, and they assigned me 8 shows, and Legacy Falls wasn't one of them, so that's why I'm not going.
Hmm. All right, so I guess we'll come back and visit next week on the various things you guys saw then. So this week in the news, we had the official announcement of Idina Menzel's If Then is going to come in. I guess I shouldn't call it her show, but she's in it. But Tom Kitt might be upset. Tom Kitt and Brian Yorkie and Michael Greif might be upset if I said it was her show. But it's a collaborative effort, isn't theater? So it's going to be opening up March 4th, 2014. As we are thinking of this overbearing heat, we can think that in March 4th, we'll be complaining about the cold and wanting this heat back.
Well, I suspect Idina Menzel and those two writers will heat up things quite a bit, actually. Isn't it wonderful that we suddenly have a high-profile show that we knew that there was going to be a tryout here or there, but I mean, to actually get it firmed up, because here's Idina Menzel, beloved by so many, and rightfully so, and Next to Normal really turned out to be a tremendous success, even though it went through some terrible growing pains, but once again proving that anything can happen if you just have the time to work on it and do work on it. And the idea of these two guys' next show is a very exciting prospect for a lot of people who live and die by Next to Normal. So so good luck to everybody concerned.
Is there maybe a possibility of looking for lightning to strike twice, as If Then is, could in essence be a follow-up to Next to Normal insofar as the characters go?
I don't know about that, but I will say that if they have a big hit with this, these are going to be writers who are going to be coveted like crazy for the next couple of decades, because there's nothing better than having 2 hits in a row. Then you become legendary when that happens. So I'm rooting for them to happen. They're very nice guys, and certainly Idina Menzel is a tremendous performer. What I really like is when I go back to a show late in the run, and I see how people are behaving. Are people walking through it? You know, I mean, that type of thing. You know, yesterday I was in Sharon, Connecticut, seeing they're playing our song, and there were 50 people in the house. I would say the average age was about 131, and and nobody was responding to the material at all. They just were sitting there. And I'm telling you, those two performers were giving 100% and then some, acting as if it were full house, and they were being appreciated like crazy. And I always admire that when that happens. And the thing is, I went back to see Wicked at a performance that, you should pardon the expression, didn't count. I mean, no critics were there, nothing like that. I just happened to be passing by one night, and somebody was selling a ticket, and I thought, yeah, why not? You know, it was February into the run, and to watch this lady really galvanize the audience was really something. So as a result, you know, I certainly with Rent too, I went back sometimes, and you know, she was magnificent there. She really turns on the juice, and And so I have great respect for her. And the idea of her in a Kit and Yuki show really sounds like it's going to be something.
So moving down the block, or actually just down the stairs from Wicked, Soul Doctor is opening up at Circle in the Square. Have you guys got it on your calendar to go see it?
I don't. I haven't been invited. Have you, Michael?
I think it. I just got it.
Yeah,
just in the past few days. You might want to recheck your email. But it's not. It's not. I think the when is the opening? It's not for.
Not for a few weeks yet. But it's interesting to open up something in July, and we'll see how this go. It's the show. They bill itself as the real-life story of the controversial Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach and his passion for music and his relationship with Nina Simone. So,
it just to me, this could be the greatest show ever written, and I just can't see how it could be.
Yeah, Marshall.
Because it just sounds like you know, and there's no stars in it. It's the subject matter is a little odd. It's not someone who. Although apparently, you know, to read the press materials, he was very, very influential and very interesting. I don't think most people know who that person is. And I, you know, so I you know, who I could be wrong, but I think that I just don't know how it could be a success.
So coming up in front of us in the week ahead, Patti LuPone is going to 54 Below with her show Coulda, Woulda, Shoulda. Are you guys going to see it, Michael? I would think more than.
Where is she doing it?
54 Below.
No. I saw her do it some years ago at, I think it was Carnegie Hall, and it was quite something. But since then, I've changed my opinion. So.
I'm going tonight there to see Jackie Hoffman, who I'm looking forward to. So that should be fun.
One thing I missed, and I'm really sorry I did. I just could not schedule it. Was Mimi Hines did a club act this past week at 54 Below, and apparently it was quite extraordinary. She's 80 now, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she just turned 80. Yeah.
But as of a few years ago, I know that she still had like 90% of her voice.
You bet.
And she's really something. So I'm sorry I missed that. I hope she can. Apparently, it was a huge success. So maybe she'll figure out a way and the time to do it again.
Isn't it wonderful? We're talking about 54 Below so much. I mean, that place really seems to be flying. I mean, I haven't looked over financial reports, but nevertheless, the fact is, every time you turn around, somebody's there. So, I mean, it's not like that place is empty. I live in the neighborhood, and you do too, Michael. But,
yeah.
I mean, I wonder if you see as much as I do when I'm passing by. You know, I see, like, tonight at 6, tonight at 8, tonight at 10. You know, I mean, it really seems like it's not only that somebody's appearing there, but they really have them stacked up like airplanes at Newark Airport.
They're the CBGBs of Broadway, you know?
Yes, I hope so. And, you know, it's a pretty room, and I really wish it well. So, but it seems to be doing very, very well, and I hope I'm not wrong about that.
Again, that's what I thought in terms of the quality of the shows. I haven't seen one show there that wasn't great. The people they get is absolutely amazing.
Yes, it is.
I hear that they're struggling. I guess it just because of the financial model of a place like that. It just seems for some reason. That's second or third hand. So it could be false, or maybe it's exaggerated, and maybe it's not true at all. But I hope it. Yeah, I hope it's not true. I was thinking that we have not heard anything about Feinstein's. We were supposed to get an announcement sometime shortly after the first of this year as to where they would be, and that never happened. So who knows? I really have no clue about that.
Yeah, so maybe that's like one of those closed for renovation signs you see for 4 years on a storefront, you know? So
right.
It could very well be, yeah.
So also in the news and we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, today is the last day of Murder Ballad. We talked about that. And then later on in the week. We have the preview start. Did the preview start already for Lubbs Labor Lost, or is it this week it starts?
It must be around now, because my invitation isn't so far off. So and they tend to bring in critics very late for that venue. But this is a musical version, yeah, isn't it?
I mean, yes.
It's not just quite Lubbs Labor's Lost as usual. And I don't think they mean, like the music is, Shakespeare used to write songs like Twelfth Night. A lot of people even consider the first musical because there are six songs in it. But nevertheless, I think this is a real musical. So let's hope for the best.
Well, speaking of real musicals, Let It Be is opening on the 24th, which is Wednesday, featuring the songs of the Beatles, of course. And
I haven't read the details, but I hear there's some kind of a lawsuit.
Yeah, the people who did Rain don't like this much happening. So,
yeah, lawsuits. Did you hear about this Kathy Rigby Peter Pan lawsuit?
Yeah.
Who's it, the musical director or arranger?
Craig Barna.
Is suing for, I don't know, for credit or for...
I guess supposedly, in a nutshell, the thing is that he supposedly did a lot of... I don't know exactly, they phrase it as writing new songs, but that's not true.
Yeah, I agree.
I guess he wrote a lot, maybe rewrote or composed or rearranged a lot of the incidental and dance music. And now it's been incorporated supposedly into, as being licensed to be done by other people, and he is receiving no remuneration. And apparently that's a very huge gray area. That I didn't really know about. When people do that kind of work for a show, whether or not they should receive royalties or just, a flat fee, and then it's owned by the producers. So I guess this is a test case, or will be a test case for that.
Alrighty, so
I have some a scoop. I forgot to.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. The production of I always have to pause to think of the title of this show because I always mix it up, but it's A Trip to Bountiful. Was extended quite a lot, but I'm told that Cicely Tyson can't do the full extension for whatever reason, and that the person they are going to bring in is Diane Carroll.
Really?
Yeah.
How interesting.
It's quite a reliable source. Nothing's definite, of course, but you
heard it here first.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Excellent. Excellent. So what is coming up on the agenda for the two of you this week?
I'm going to Wichita to see Betty Blue Eyes, a London musical that didn't do too well over there. But nevertheless, the cast album by two of my favorite contemporary writers, Drew and Stiles. I mean, I adore their work, be it from Practically Perfect in Mary Poppins, which is a great show song, to their own version of Peter Pan. They did a Peter Pan, and before I started listening, I thought, what's the point of this? I mean, we have a Peter Pan musical. I tell you, I like the Captain Hook song so much more than the ones that show up in that famous musical.
Wow.
So, the Lost Boys really seem butch in the way that they wrote them too. So I like that very much as well. So, so they're favorite writers of mine, and so that's why I cannot wait to see this Betty Blue Eyes, which has, from its London cast album, at least four songs that I am crazy about. So I'm looking forward to seeing them on stage. Wayne Bryan, who always does an excellent job of directing, is directing. And going out to Wichita to see what goes on out there is just amazing, because they only do their shows for a week. They're in a 2,000-seat theater, and I'm telling you, they fill that place because this is the thing to do in Wichita. And while you can say, well, what else is there to do in Wichita, the fact remains that plenty of other cities have nothing to do and the people don't go to the theater. But this is the place. They appreciate him so much, and they just love to get there, and they just have the best time. And now this is going to be a challenge because this is a very British show. I mean, this deals with Britain after the war. It's set in Britain. It's based on that movie, A Private Function, and we shall see what we shall see if the audience does respond to it. But I am looking forward to seeing it, not once, not twice, but three times, which is what I do when I go to Wichita. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Wow.
So I totally had a mental breakdown here. Betty Blue Eyes is not about the pig?
It is about the pig.
It is. It's the Cameron McIntosh thing that was...
Right. Yeah, that's it.
Okay. I just didn't connect that. Okay. Michael, what were you saying?
Oh, just that in addition to all the nymph stuff I'm going to be seeing, this is the week of I'm getting my act together and taking it on the road at Encore's Off Center. And I'm looking forward to that. I've never seen the show.
Oh, it's very good. Yeah. I wish I could go, but I'll be in Wichita, so...
And by the way, last week, the Encores did a one-nighter of Violet, which I did not see, and I hear it went very, very
well. Yeah, I heard that too, yeah.
With Sutton Foster. So, people are buzzing, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Transfer, you know, revival. Who knows?
So, getting my act together and taking it on the road is Gretchen Carr's musical.
Mm-hmm. And Nancy Ford, yeah.
Nancy Ford, yeah. Gretchen is working on a new show called Possibility Junkie that's opening up in in late September, early October. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with these things. I guess that's about it for this week. I don't want to be remiss, and I want to say happy birthday to June Thomas. June Thomas, one of the culture editors over at Slate.com. And she's great. We love her and a huge fan.
Oh,
Broadway, good friend to Broadway.
And can we say rest in peace to Miller Wright?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who was strange. A wonderful press agent and died suddenly this past week. I don't know the details, so we can't give you
nobody
any.
Seems to yeah.
All righty, so I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link, that way each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can also listen to us in the Stitcher app. That's an application for your iPhone, your Android device, and your BlackBerry. That way you can stream This Week on Broadway directly to you, or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you do have a moment, please stop by iTunes and leave us a review, because those reviews help other Broadway fans find us a little bit easier. Our page at BroadwayRadio.com, there are links to some of the things we talked about today, as well as contact information for Peter, Michael, and me. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
See ya.
Go away. Wonderful woman again.